Kath, the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy. Today's training was developed by the ITRC team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to cover some introductory material on the first few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC team. Today's training is based on the guidance document, the Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy document. We're going to introduce you to the document during today's training class, and we do hope that it becomes a resource that you can use after today's training. Our class is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover as we're getting started today. Today's course is 2.25 hours. We are recording the training session. Today, the trainers are going to control your slides. If you want to control your own slides, you can download the presentation file, and that's available back on that CLUIN training page where you started today. We do look for your questions and feedback. Throughout today's training class, you are welcome to send in questions, and that's in the bottom right. We have a Q&A box. In some cases, we'll get right back to you with answers. For other questions, we'll ask those out loud during our question and answer breaks. We're going to have one in the middle and another at the end of the training class. At the end of the class, we do look for your feedback. We really do use the information that you provide. Also, completing the feedback form is also your opportunity to create a certificate for attending today's training class. So if you want a certificate of participation, attend the class, complete the feedback form, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. If you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box. Once you submit, the system is going to generate that certificate for you. And right now, the only way to get that certificate is by completing the feedback form. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States. Overall, ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. It includes our federal partners, members of industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We encourage you to use the ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. We ask that you please credit ITRC, review the ITRC usage policy, and let us know about your successes. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. I do encourage you to visit the ITRC website to learn more about other guidance documents on this same topic area that are available. We have a couple online training classes coming up next week in the similar topic areas that I encourage you to register for and attend. There's also opportunities to join new ITRC teams, so please visit the ITRC website to learn what is available. I'll introduce our trainers for today's class. All the trainers were members of the ITRC Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy team. That team was led by Najee Akladis of the Maine Department of Environmental Protection. Alex McDonald is a senior engineer in the technical support section of the cleanup unit at the Central Valley Regional Water Quality Control Board in California. He primarily works on cleanup of the Aerojet site in Rancho Cordova and other nearby sites such as McCullen Air Force Base. Ryan Wymore works for CDM Smith in Denver, Colorado. He specializes in innovative groundwater remediation technologies, particularly bioremediation, monitored natural attenuation, and chemical oxidation. Trevor King is a remediation technical lead with the AECOM DNAPL team in Pennsylvania. He has global experience in the planning, implementation, and management of environmental and DNAPL remediation projects. Dr. Dan Bryant is the in-situ remediation practice leader for Woodald and Curran in East Windsor, New Jersey. He holds 3 patents related to biological and chemical in-situ treatment technologies and is involved in the design and implementation of in-situ chemical oxidation projects in the U.S. and Europe. Aaron Cohen is a project contract manager at the Florida Department of Environmental Protection in Tallahassee. He supervises and coordinates the cleanup of chlorinated solvent and hazardous waste sites within the Florida Dry Cleaning Solvent Cleanup Program, the state-funded hazardous waste program, and Superfund. Dr. Tamsin McBeth is a vice president at CDM Smith in Helena, Montana. She specializes in the development and demonstration and application of innovative, cost-effective technologies for contaminated groundwater. On slide 6, I'll now turn today's presentation over to Alex McDonald at the California Water Board. Alex?
Thank you, Juliana. During the development of previous ITRC documents on DNAPL, it became clear to our team that there were many DNAPL sites where there's really no clear strategy in dealing with them. At a number of sites, money was continually being spent over long periods of time, and there wasn't sufficient environmental benefits being seen. We determined that a process for developing DNAPL strategy was needed, and thus production of our integrated DNAPL site strategy document, which we believe can significantly improve the investigation and cleanup at these types of sites. Slide 7. We found that there were four main challenges associated with DNAPL sites. First, in order to efficiently clean up a site, you have to have enough knowledge of the site, and that knowledge has to do with things like geology, hydrogeology, source strength, location of the DNAPL, and other components of appropriate of contamination. Many times, there's not an adequate understanding of the site to allow appropriate decisions, remediation decisions to be made. Secondly, the DNAPL matrix is complex, leading to the contamination being found in free, dissolved, and vapor phases, besides the DNAPL phase. The complexity is compounded by the different phases being found in a variety of geologic media, and even in man-made things such as trenches, pipelines, that sort of thing. Third, some remedial objectives are established that are unrealistic in that they may not be able to be measured or achieved in a reasonable period of time. And lastly, if the remedy selected does not work, the process is not in place to determine what to do next. We needed to come up with something to improve the odds of success. Our IDSS document helps improve chance of success despite all these challenges. Slide 8. So what is our IDSS team? It's not unlike any other ITRC team that we found around the country in many disciplines. We found the two main components tend to be the states, the regulatory agencies, the states, and the federal government. Then we have community stakeholders, industry components. We have members of the academia on our team. And the biggest group by far is the industrial group, represent the industrial facilities, as you see here on the far right part of the slide. Most of the team members have been together for quite some time developing several ITRC documents on evaluation and remediation of DNAPL sites. So how do we deal with the challenges we have found? Move to slide 9. Our proposed solution is the IDSS. This IDSS is a comprehensive management approach to dealing with the site. It is a process, remember this is a process by which a project team can develop a site-specific strategy. It is not, I emphasize, not a site-specific strategy itself, as each site has its own nuances that will affect the strategy. This IDSS is ideally used as early in the site evaluation and remediation process as practical, and the developed site-specific strategy added to as new information on the site is known. This IDSS is not for the remediation novice, but used by those with site evaluation and cleanup experience, as DNAPL remediation is a complex issue. Also, this is important to also note that you do need not to have DNAPLs at your site to use this strategy. The concept can be applied to even with sites that do not have DNAPLs. And before we leave this the slide, at the bottom of the slide, make sure you go down to the ITRC website and download a copy of the strategy. Free of charge to anyone who wants it. Move to slide 10. This slide shows our flowchart for establishing integrated DNAPL site strategy and also the roadmap through our document. We also use this as the order in which we will present the training you're going to go through today. First, we start with development of a site conceptual model. A most important first step in that without a good site conceptual model, developing a remedy that will work as wanted is difficult at best. Next, we proceed with establishing remedial objectives. What we believe is a better way to establish those objectives using SMART criteria is presented in this process. We can then choose a remedial approach to meet those objectives. In order to determine how effective the remedy is, monitoring is needed. And based on the monitoring, the effectiveness of the remedy is then determined. And lastly, the remedy is evaluated to determine if alternate remedies are needed, if the conceptual site model needs to be updated, if the objectives need to be modified, and if a more effective remedy can be implemented. Move to slide 11. So what are we going to learn? What are you guys going to learn today? Coupled with reading the document, you mentioned you have to read the document. This training really only gives you a basic overview of the document and some specifics, but you really need to look at that document. First, how to develop a site-specific cleanup strategy for your site. How the development of SMART objectives provides a better way to measure site cleanup. How, where, and why to measure remediation performance and progress of achieving cleanup objectives. How to couple and transition between remedy technologies. And if your remedial approach does not seem to be working, how to go about reevaluating and improving that remedy. Well, that completes the introduction. And now let's get on to the really interesting stuff. So we'll start with off of the Ryan Wymore and development of the site conceptual model.
All right. Thank you, Alex. So as has been noted so far in the training, the IDSS is a process. The very beginning of that process looks at the conceptual site model. The idea being, if you can't understand the problem, you probably aren't going to be able to solve it. So in the document, we go through several elements that are central to developing and refining a conceptual site model. Things like what part of the site is contaminated, vadose zone, saturated zone, surface water, maybe soil vapor, something else. You have to think about receptors, how the contaminants are going to get to the receptors, and then also developing a technical understanding of the subsurface conditions, things such as the contaminant distribution, the geology, hydrogeology, fate and transport, etc. So moving to slide 13, if your conceptual site model looks something like this, you might need to provide an update or do some refinement. This level of understanding is sort of how maybe we used to think about things a couple of decades ago, but we now know that the thinking that went into these kinds of sites decades ago is not adequate to solve the problems now. So the technical concepts that are covered in the document that I'll just touch on here today that are central to conceptual site models, specifically at DNAPL sites, are shown here. So we talk about the geology, we talk about the contaminant distribution, the diffusion, idea of back diffusion, which I'll talk about in a few slides, the source plume relationship, the properties of the DNAPLs themselves, as well as the response to treatment at different life cycle stages of a DNAPL site. I do want to mention that because of the importance of this step, the importance of this step to the IDSS, the ITRC did develop a subsequent document called the Integrated Site Characterization that Juliana mentioned at the beginning. There's a training on that next week, so check that out if you're interested in more detail. That newer document covers in great detail some of the elements that we summarize here in the IDSS. So when we think about chlorinated solvent releases, one of the important concepts to understand is the different phases of chemicals or contaminants that can be present. As we show down at the lower right part of this slide, the DNAPL contaminants can be present as the separate phase DNAPL. They can dissolve into groundwater, can sorb to the aquifer matrix, or can volatilize into the vapor phase. There can be mass transfer or interphase chemical mass transfer between these various phases that changes where the contaminant is present over time. It's important to understand these interactions and understand where the mass is present at your site and in what phase that it's present at your site. One important concept that we talk about in the document is this idea of mobile DNAPL versus residual DNAPL. So the idea is that mobile DNAPL is an interconnected separate phase that is capable of migrating itself. So this is shown in the upper picture on the slide where the DNAPL is a continuous phase and it's present in a form that literally can flow through the subsurface. It can displace water and it can move, typically downward because it's denser than water. Residual DNAPL is shown in the bottom frame. That is when the DNAPL is disconnected, present in what we call blobs and ganglia that are not capable of migrating. So in this case, it is a separate phase. This DNAPL can dissolve into groundwater and sustain plumes for long periods of time, but migration as a separate DNAPL phase won't happen when it's at a residual saturation. In that context, understanding what phase the DNAPL is present in, it's also important to understand the importance of the geology, of the heterogeneity. And so we talk about some of the tools and concepts that allow us to build this understanding of the subsurface. And what we start finding is that some of the simplifying assumptions maybe that have been made in the past really underrepresent the actual complexities of these sites. So, you know, maybe this simplified concept we show at the top, you try to represent as an intermediate complexity model with some 3D model cells set up. But in reality, on the lower left, you know, reality is really complex. And we've got not only the various phases that can be present at DNAPL sites in terms of the contaminant, overlaying on that, you have the understanding of the geology and the lithology, and those various phases can be present in low permeability zones, high permeability zones, and even in fractured rock. So one simple illustration that reflects more of the current understanding of really what can sustain plumes for long periods of time. We show in the top figure a DNAPL pool that is configured as this red rectangle that represents a discrete release that happens, say, at time zero. And we have the DNAPL phase moving downward through this semi-infinite sand and migrating toward this semi-infinite clay that's below it. We also have, during this time, the DNAPL contaminant is dissolving into the groundwater, moving down gradient in the semi-infinite sand. But the key process here is represented by the red arrows migrating out of the DNAPL pool. The DNAPL is diffusing into the low permeability zones over time and essentially loading up this low permeability clay with contaminant. This diffusion also happens from the aqueous phase, so the DNAPL constituent that is dissolving and moving down gradient, maybe it's TCE or PCE, that contaminant is also diffusing into this low permeability zone. The concentration gradient isn't as steep, so that's why we show these arrows as a lighter color red, but this forward diffusion is still happening. At some later time, which is represented by the bottom figure, we have the DNAPL has been exhausted, so the pool is gone. It's maybe present at a residual saturation like we just discussed. And for by whatever mechanism, the semi-infinite sand has largely flushed clean. So whether that's just from natural groundwater advection or maybe pump and treat or some kind of a remedy, something has reduced the concentration in the sand, but now we have what we call back diffusion, where the contaminants that are present in high concentrations in the low permeability zone are now diffusing back out into the semi-infinite sand and sustaining this plume. And so you'll notice that this happens not just in the shadow of the former DNAPL release. This also happens down gradient that can be spatially separated from where the DNAPL was actually released to the environment. So this is kind of the updated understanding that the quote-unquote source for the plume in this case is not just where the DNAPL was released, but it's also this clay that is back diffusing contaminants into the sand. So let's look at this with a very simplified cross-section. So we have here some contrasting zones of permeability. So we've got this kind of purple high permeability zone in the middle, some medium permeability zones, maybe that's like a sand, and the high permeability zones of gravel, and then maybe some clay lenses. So in this context, as we move to slide 20, we're going to do a hypothetical DNAPL release, and we're going to look at the evolution of the source and the plume over time in three different stages. So this first stage we call the early stage, where we show the DNAPL itself is still present as the red color. It is migrating downward. In this case, it's above the residual saturation, so this is in a mobile phase, so the DNAPL is migrating itself. You have high concentrations dissolving out of the DNAPL that are moving down gradient, that's shown by the yellow and the green. And this constituent, let's say it's TCE, is encountering that high permeability zone and moving off down gradient. That's where it's going to migrate the fastest. But in this illustration, most of the contaminant mass is still going to be present in the DNAPL phase. Slide 21 is this middle stage where essentially the mobile DNAPL phase is gone and everything is sort of evened out. So there's moderate concentrations present in the low permeability zones, at least the ones that are above the gravel zone. And there's also moderate concentrations present in that gravel zone. So really, this middle stage, it's a relatively uniform contaminant distribution, and we don't have a lot of diffusion going on, because there aren't really any concentration gradients. In the late stage, this is where, after some period of time has passed, the DNAPL is gone, and the high permeability zones have reduced concentration. So again, maybe this is just by natural flushing, natural advection, where the lower concentrations are actually present in that gravel, and now the higher concentrations are in the moderate and low permeability zones. And again, this is where we're going to have that back diffusion. So now in this case, you're going to have back diffusion from the adjacent lower permeability zones, sustaining and providing mass to the high permeability zone, again, far away potentially from where the initial DNAPL release happened. So moving to slide 23, let's think about this early, middle, and late stage in the context of the response to treatment. So the response to treatment and essentially the effectiveness could be dependent on which stage of the plume that you have. So you have to ask, is, you know, how accessible is the contaminant mass to treatment? Let's look at the early stage. If you're able to apply a treatment to the footprint where the DNAPL was released, so maybe within the red and the yellow zone, so you're encompassing the DNAPL phase and the high concentrations immediately surrounding it, and you apply some kind of aggressive remediation, whether it's something simple like excavation or perhaps something like in-situ thermal, you're going to remove a lot of contaminant mass and maybe prevent some of this forward diffusion that can sustain plumes in the late stage. So in that case, you might have a very effective treatment. But if you think about a late stage plume, where most of the contaminant mass is tied up in the low permeability zones, and you're going to apply that same treatment, and you're going to say, well, let's go in and aggressively treat the area where the DNAPL release happened, there's actually may not be a whole lot of mass left in that area, and you may not see concentrations down gradient of your treatment zone respond very much, just because most of the mass is not present in that area anymore. In that case, you've got the back diffusion controlling your plume response. So you just have to think about, when you're building the conceptual model for your site, where the mass is stored and where it's being transported. And we note that a lot of the in-situ treatments that we implement, such as bioremediation or chemical oxidation, we're injecting into these higher permeability zones and preferentially remediating those, but that may not be sufficient to restore a site. So there was a study done a few years ago that just looked at plume response to source treatment. So this was some modeling exercises that looked at basically the plume flux reduction in response to source treatment. So the source mass reduction is shown on the x-axis, and the plume response is shown on the y-axis. Right down the middle is the one-to-one relationship. So you can imagine you remove 50% of the source mass, then you have a 50% plume flux reduction. So back at this time, you know, maybe 15 years ago, there was this big argument in the remediation industry, you know, whether you should even attempt to remediate source areas, you know, where there was still a DNAPL phase present. One camp would say that, yes, you should most definitely go after these source areas because you can get a lot of mass out and you can have, you know, you can see huge benefits down gradient in terms of a flux reduction. And other people would say, no, no, you don't even bother with it because you can remove a lot of mass from the source area and it's just not going to make much of an impact down gradient. Well, what this study shows is that they were both right. And the reason they're both right is it depends on how heterogeneous the site is. So if we look at one of these upper curves, what we can see is that if you remove a relatively, you know, modest amount of mass, let's say 40%, you can have something like an 80% flux reduction down gradient. If you have a very homogeneous site, that same mass removal gets a very low plume flux reduction. And the reason is, if you think about kind of what we just walked through, at these heterogeneous sites, you're remediating the permeable zones that are having the most groundwater move through them, and therefore you're removing the most mass in terms of the flux that can move down gradient. The other thing to note is at these heterogeneous sites, let's say that this 80% reduction is not enough. If you have to get from an 80% flux reduction to something like a 95% flux reduction, you have to move way up this curve of source mass reduction. So it can be really tough to kind of get the rest of the way at these heterogeneous sites. All right, so moving to slide 25, one of the kind of cool things that our team adopted was called the 14-compartment model that was developed by Tom Sale and Chuck Newell a few years ago. We put it into our document because it really fits with this concept of understanding where the mass is present at your site and what stage of evolution your site is at. So the 14-compartment model is simply this matrix where we show the contaminant phase or zone down the side. And then we group it, we say in the source zone and in the plume, we have as a generalization, low permeability units and transmissive zones. So you kind of lump all those together. And it's the 14-compartment model instead of the 16-compartment model because you don't have a DNAPL phase in the plume by definition. So the idea here is there are these 14 compartments that can have mass transfer happening among the compartments from one to the other that can impact over time where the mass is currently and where it's going to move to. But if you think about this in terms of treatment, let's overlay this on our early, middle, and late stage. So again, this is the idea here, this is just a framework for thinking about these sites. We're representing relative aqueous phase equivalent concentration, so it's not mass-based, so we're not saying that, you know, this is any kind of quantifiable method where you can assign percentages or anything like that, but it's just a framework to think about, you know, where the highest concentrations are. So let's say at this early stage, we're mainly having the contaminant present in the transmissive zones because we haven't had time for the diffusion to load up the low permeability zones. So at the early stage in the source, we have high concentrations in the DNAPL, obviously, because the DNAPL is, you know, it's pure contaminant. Moderate concentrations in these other phases in the transmissive zone, but the low permeability zones, we still have low concentrations. Down gradient, it's low concentrations everywhere except maybe the aqueous phase in the transmissive zone, because again, we have this gravel unit that maybe is carrying mass kind of the furthest down gradient, so maybe that shows up as moderate. And the middle stage, again, this is where everything is kind of evened out. So we show these, you know, basically moderate everywhere in the source in terms of the transmissive and the low permeability zones and then down gradient as well. So again, everything's kind of evened out in this stage of the evolution. The late stage is where it gets interesting because now all the transmissive zones have low concentrations. We're even showing that as the green here. And then in the source, you have maybe moderate concentrations in the low permeability zones, aqueous and sorbed, and the same thing down gradient. So again, with this 14-compartment model framework, you think about implementing a remedy at a late-stage site. If all you do is just, inject some kind of an amendment, let's say it's a bioamendment, and you're not intentional about trying to treat the low permeability zones, you just kind of let it go where it's going to go and you don't really take any care to do otherwise, you're essentially only going to remediate one compartment. You're going to remediate the transmissive portion in the aqueous phase in the source, and maybe some down gradient as well. But you're leaving all these other compartments unaddressed, at least by active remediation. So that's kind of the power of thinking about it this way. And again, we aren't trying to make it, seem hopeless or anything like that. We're just trying to convey the complexity that these sites represent and the kind of higher level thinking that goes into characterizing and remediating them properly. So the last thing in the CSM that we touch on that can be really important at some sites is basically the whole vapor intrusion pathway and soil gas, contaminants present in the soil gas. At some sites, especially if a release happens around any kind of buildings and you do have some kind of a residual DNAPL phase, if it's a shallow site or the DNAPL migrated through the vadose zone, vapor intrusion can be a big deal. There was one site that I worked on where even down gradient of a source, where aqueous concentrations of a DCE was pretty low, something like, tens of micrograms per liter, certainly less than 50. Those kind of concentrations were of concern for vapor intrusion at that site just because the pathway was essentially complete. It was very shallow. The homes had basements, and so it was what was driving the cleanup in that case. So it's not something that should just kind of be swept aside at these solvent sites. It really needs to be considered as a central part of the CSM. So to wrap up the conceptual site model section, we just want to emphasize, how well do you really understand your site? This is something that, you can think about really at any stage of the process. This is not something that you just think about once kind of at the beginning and then set it aside while you're going through the rest of the process. You need to kind of keep it in mind and update the CSM continually. As I mentioned, we have this other resource that's now available, the Integrated DNAPL Site Characterization document. That's the website for it here, and then the training. Like I mentioned, there's an offering coming up in the next few days. This just goes into a lot more detail on this step two of the IDSS, the CSM. We talk about the process. We have this great resource for tools selection where there's over 100 tools built into this spreadsheet-based downloadable file that you can sort through, and it has a lot of great information on what tools are available to characterize these kind of sites. So definitely check that one out. All right, so we're done with the conceptual site model. I will now turn it over to Trevor to talk us through the remedial objectives step.
Thank you, Ryan, and welcome everyone. Can you hear me, Ryan?
We can hear you, Trevor.
Great. So we are now on Chapter 3, which is remedial objectives. That's slide 29 for those who are following along on a hard copy. So I'm here to talk to you today about setting clear and concise remedial objectives. And I want to be able to show you the tremendous benefit these objectives will bring to your projects. You know, when we were preparing this document several years ago, there were about 30 plus team members with over 400 years of experience. And there was a lot of deliberation on objectives. And in the end, we basically agreed that, for remedial objectives, they really needed to be clear and concise. If not, it's very difficult to measure success and will result in costly overruns. And this was based on the experience of this team over several decades. So the purpose of my presentation today is to answer answer two questions. First, I want to be able to answer, how do we define clear and concise objectives? And secondly, you know, what is the process, you know, to make objectives SMART? So SMART is really an acronym for specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and time-bound. And this was actually developed by Doran and has since been adopted by the American Management Association in many of their management products. Finally, as part of my presentation, you know, we are going to work an example to set and test SMART objectives. So with that, let's get into it. So there are really two types of objectives we look at this afternoon. They're absolute objectives and they're functional objectives. So in our experience, you may be more familiar, as I was, about CERCLA objectives. These are commonly referred to as remedial action objectives, and they can either be, you know, interim or final objectives. However, for the guidance document, after deliberating for some time, as I mentioned, we elected to use absolute and functional objectives because we felt they can distinguish between ill-defined objectives and what is concise and measurable objectives. So if I was to put this into context, what would it look like? For example, absolute objectives could read and are based on broad social values, as the slide says. And it could be, we want to protect human health and the environment, or another one could be, you know, conservation of natural resources. Now, the problem with these objectives, as I just mentioned, is what would attainment look like? For some, it's maybe, you know, we got to reach MCLs, or you want to restore an impacted land or an aquifer so that you end up with beneficial use. So that may be all well and good, but then we need to figure out what are the functional objectives to meet that absolute objective. So functional objectives, in summary, are basically all the steps or actions we need to take as practitioners to obtain the absolute objective. So functional objectives, should allow measurement along the process. You know, as you move through the process of some type of remedial action, you're measuring your progress continuously. Those steps would qualify as functional objectives. Again, the challenge is, what would that look like and how will we measure them? So the Integrated Inapplicite Strategy document has included a table. It's table 3-1 in the guidance document that gives you many examples of generic, absolute, and functional objectives. I would encourage you to take some time to look at those. So as I mentioned, you know, I introduced the concept of SMART. So what is SMART? If we look at SMART, as I said, the S stands for specific. It needs to be measurable, attainable, relevant, and time-bound. So let's look at each of these and figure out how it's used. So for a functional objective to be specific, it means that that objective needs to be detailed and well-defined. The question is, how do we make this determination? I would suggest that in order to do so, we can ask ourselves one of many diagnostic questions. And this is the process. You ask yourself these questions. You know, for example, what is it you're actually trying to do if you have a remedial action? What do you want to achieve? If you can begin to answer these questions, then you're actually converging on a specific criteria for your functional objective. The next one is all about measurable. That means that the parameters should be specified and they need to be quantifiable. For example, we can say we want to treat soil for, let's say, a VI issue, but unless we quantify how much we want to reduce that soil concentration by, for example, X micrograms per kilogram, you know, we wouldn't be able to measure what success looks like. The third attribute is attainable. And what this means is that the functional objective needs to be realistic within the proposed time frame and the availability of resources. It makes no sense to want to be able to do something if you don't have the resources available. That means that you'll never be able to succeed. So the question we may ask ourselves for this criteria is, has anyone done this before? You know, what can we do? For example, if we implement the technology and it doesn't meet the criteria, in this case, the X micrograms per kilogram I mentioned previously. The next the criteria is relevant. It needs to be relevant. Does it have value? Does it represent realistic expectations? A good diagnostic question we can ask ourselves is, you know, does this outcome of the objective directly support the achievement of the absolute objective? If it does, all well and good. If it doesn't, then we have a problem. And the last and important criteria is, you know, is time. This means that what we meant here is that we need to be able to clearly define and you know, the time frame. And that time frame needs to be short enough to ensure accountability by those who are setting the objective. In some cases, we may come up with a time frame of 10 years. In other cases, it's 50 years, or if we're doing a bio, we may say 100 years. Well, the bottom line is most of us are not going to be around for, you know, the 50 or 100 years, so there's little accountability in that realm. So there are several functional objectives that are actually included in the in our guidance document, and so I like to encourage you to look at those as well. And so my next slide is really to reinforce one of these objectives, and that is the time frame objective. This is actually the most difficult one for us because how do you quantify this particular attribute? So we actually basically landed on four criteria that we need to ask ourselves as practitioners when we are establishing time frames. And the criteria are, the first one is all about accountability. I kind of mentioned that a minute ago. And the question is, the stakeholders who set these objectives, they need to remain responsible for their decisions. I am working on a project right now, and we're actually reviewing a project. And work, remedial investigations were completed in the 1990s. IRMs were consent orders, and IRMs were installed in the 90s. These systems are still ongoing in 2017, and today we are thinking of, well, there may need to be additional characterization. Now, the people who set those objectives, they're no longer comfortable. They're no longer there. But several hundreds or millions of dollars have been spent. So that's what we kind of meant when we speak of accountability. Next, another criteria is, you know, being cognizant of the variations in your soil, or particularly your aquifer. They're changing biogeochemistry. As you implement something, there can also be natural variations, which can basically impact the performance of whatever you're doing. So you need to take that into consideration. A fourth criteria, it's all about being having reliable predictions. Don't over-predict or estimate the success of a technology. You know, we tend to use a lot of models, and the models have actually got better over the years, but to kind of rely solely on models to predict, for example, time frames, because many of these models predict, 100 years, 200 years for remedial actions, we need to be very careful. Your models need to be able to, you need to be able to calibrate your models over time. And the fourth criteria I want to mention, it's all about keeping abreast. You know, technology and science has developed at a rapid pace over the last decade. Therefore, it kind of makes sense that in our industry, which seems to always be lagging, that these technologies need to be brought to bear on our profession. Our remedial objectives and the remedial action need to be flexible so that we can accommodate the advances in technology. So the last point I want to make on time frame was the team, deliberated, as I mentioned, and we agreed that, from practical purposes, a 20-year time frame seems like a reasonable time frame to set a smart functional objective. In doing so, the team also realized that at many sites, based on the evidence that exists today, these sites are not being cleaned up for one reason or another. So in cases where a remedial action may last for longer than 20 years, what we are suggesting is that interim functional objectives be set. So there's always a metric that you could be checking along the way on the progress. So having established absolute and functional objectives are and kind of define them in terms of attributes and criteria, let's see how we can apply this. Here I have a slide. This is a site. you know, an example site, as we refer to it, and it's actually a site that is carried through the document, where one of our team members worked on. So, you know, if I was to just set this up, you can see that from the picture, the geology is really a clay silt, in the unsaturated as well as the saturated zone. And there's a transmissive silty sand zone that's anywhere between 12 and 18 feet below grade. And below that zone there is about 10 feet of clay. Depth of groundwater is about 7 feet. The source is shown, PCE. Here is shown, by the orange color. And groundwater was flowing actually on this slide from right to left. The problem was, DINAPO, it was a dry cleaner, and they were using, PCE, and the DINAPO leached into the groundwater over a two-year period. You know, the low permeability in the soil and transmissive zones in the source area and downgradient resulted in vape intrusions, both on-site as well as off-site. They did a lot of remedial investigations and characterization, and the average concentration they determined to be about 400 micrograms per kilogram, and groundwater concentrations were about 180 micrograms. That's some additional information I'm sharing with you here. As part of the work the consultant did, they did a risk assessment, and they identified four risks. One was associated with vapor intrusion into the building, both from soil as well as groundwater. There was PCE established leaching into the groundwater, and there was actually contaminated soil that was going to be left in landscaped areas. PCE was migrating off-site. So what did the finding of the risk assessment kind of develop? They were able to actually establish some criteria which the regulators subsequently agreed to. And basically, that was for VI, they needed to actually be able to remediate that soil down to about 40 micrograms per kilogram, and groundwater needed to be anywhere around 8 micrograms per liter. For the soil, they actually established something for leaching also into the groundwater. And that's just a sidebar. That was actually about 4 to 5 micrograms per kilogram they had to reach if they wanted to. The one point before I move on was this developer was interested in developing this site into a mall. And the consultant needed to do so within a 12-month time period, and there needed to be no environmental restrictions. So that was the key to this site. So if we were to look at some functional objectives and some generic, if we were to look at the absolute objectives and some functional generic objectives, we can say, well, for an absolute objective, one that we're familiar with, we want to protect human health in the environment. As for the developer, they wanted to redevelop the mall. Some generic functional objectives, and note, these are qualified as not being smart objectives, is that what they wanted to do was to deal with vapor intrusions via the soils pathway. They also wanted to reduce concentrations of volatile organics in the vedo zone. That will allow a no further action for unrestricted use. And they wanted no engineering or administrative controls. Now, if you were to look at these functional objectives in the context of what I mentioned, of whether or not they are smart, you'll see that if you were to test them, and you can do so on your own time, that none of these functional objectives are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, or time-bound. So what we need to do now is to see how we can smartify these objectives. So that's kind of what I wanted to do. So the absolute objectives remain the same. So if we were just to smartify one objective, that is the functional objective that pertains to reducing the concentration, if you read it, it will say we want to reduce the concentrations to 40, to 40 micrograms per kilogram within 6 months. Everything else remains the same with that objective, except we've added some metrics. So if we wanted to test this now against the SMART criteria, I think we can do so. So looking at specific, we can ask the question, is the objective well understood and will it lead to the desired result? I think we can pretty much say yes, because we know the starting concentration was about 4,000, and the ending concentration based on the risk assessment needed to be 40. This actually represents about a 99% reduction. That is specific. We know where we're starting. We know where we needed to get to. Now let's look at measurable. Is this measurable? Now, if we implement a remedial, if we were to implement a remedial action, at the end of that or during that process, we can go in and we can take confirmation samples, and we can take as many samples as needed to confirm whether or not we have attained the 40 micrograms per kilogram. So yes, I would petition that it is measurable, because we know how we can prove out that we've reached that objective. The next criteria is achievable. So there are so many technologies out there that can be used to possibly treat this problem. However, if you recall, there was a metric that says it needed to allow not only get a no further action for the soil, but we wanted to do so within a certain time frame. So we could use possibly excavation. That's a very reliable technology. The depths are not too problematic and possibly costly. And we know that once we implement an excavation program, that that can be implemented in a very short time frame. So it's reliable. There are other technologies such as vapor extraction or ISCO that could have been implemented, because we know from our practice and evidence over a decade that some of these technologies, they can also reduce soil concentrations by the 99% or so. The kicker here was, would it be achievable within the 6-month time frame that was established? And that's where the question lies. And if I was doing this, I would probably err and probably not, but excavation was a greater certainty. The next criteria, relevant, is what is being proposed relevant? Would it allow us to get a possible no further action? The answer is, again, here, yes. And the time-bound criteria, 6 months. Can this be done within 6 months? With an excavation program, I would say, yes, it could be done within 6 months. So by simply restating your functional objective and adding a few metrics, you can see how we've changed what was a non-smart function objective into one that is now smart, that has that we can monitor along the way to measure success. So, as my parting slide before we go into the question and answer, I want to kind of make sure that you appreciate that, once you've completed your conceptual site model, only then you're ready to move into establishing your objectives. And here we are proposing absolute objectives and the functional objectives to support that objective. Once you've established that, then you're ready to talk about technologies. And this is where I'm going to be handing it over in the next session to Dr. Bryant, who is an expert with technologies, and he's going to guide us through. But before we do so, I'd like to hand it back to Juliana, because we have a question and answer period.
Thank you, Trevor. Everyone is welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. If you're on the phone line, it's #6. You're welcome to unmute and jump in with a question. As we're waiting for questions to come in, I'll also remind you of these upcoming classes. Our trainers have mentioned this. Next week, September 26, Integrated DNAPL Site Characterization. And we're going to go into a lot more detail about what Ryan talked about today. And then on September 28, we have a class on use and measurement of mass flux and mass discharge. So registration for both of those classes is available at the ITRC website, which is itrcweb.org. We have a question that's come in. Ryan actually answered it online, but I'll go ahead and ask it out loud because other people may have the same question. And this came in during the discussion of the early, middle, and late stage. So clay doesn't act as a confining layer for DNAPL?
Yeah, so Julian, I'll kind of regurgitate the answer that I sent, and that it's the shorter answer is not necessarily, because it depends on the physics of the system, and if there's enough of a driving force for the Dean Apple to overcome the entry pressure to migrate into that clay, it certainly can. And there's been examples of that happening where it was thought that a clay unit was going to isolate Dean Apple, and then it actually turns out that it, you know, migrates into that Dean Apple. So that doesn't always happen, but it also doesn't always act as a barrier.
Thank you. I'll also remind our participants at this point, we do ask that you fill out the feedback form. We really do use the feedback that you provide. So if you do leave before we wrap up, in our related links, the fourth item down goes to that feedback form. And to get those related links to work, it's a two-step process. You select the name, and then you select Browse To, and that allows those links to open in a new window. We do really use the feedback that you provide. It's also your opportunity to create a certificate of participation for attending today's class. So if you'd like a certificate, be sure to fill out the feedback form, check the box at the bottom to confirm that you attended. Once you submit, the system's going to generate that certificate for you. If you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, submit again, and that's going to allow the system to generate the feedback form for you. Also, for Trainer Tamsin McBeth, have you been able to join on the phone line and unmute?
Yes, Juliana, I'm on.
Great, thank you. Another question has come in. With respect to evaluating the early, middle, and late stage, what if the source or release date and scenario is not known? Any advice?
Yeah, this is Ryan. That's a good point that I should have explicitly stated on those slides. It's not just dependent or certainly not universal that the only factor is time since release. It depends on a whole lot of other things. How fast groundwater is moving at your site, and, you know, really importantly, what kind of Dean Apple it is. If it's a chlorinated solvent Dean Apple, a lot of those that I work on are probably late-stage sites with, you know, releases that happened a couple of decades ago or longer, but were discrete, and, you know, the Dean Apple, the mobile Dean Apple is gone. But other types of Dean Apples can be early-stage for a long time. So the way you find out the answer is to do the characterization. So, you know, do the groundwater sampling, the soil sampling, understand the partitioning between the phases. There's tools out there to help do that, and characterize the site and kind of let that tell you what stage your site is at.
As we're waiting for more questions to come in, I know several members of our trainers today are also members of the ITRC team on characterization and remediation in fractured rock. Can you all tell us a little bit about what you're working on?
Yeah, I guess I could take that one too and have others chime in. That document, we approached it in kind of a similar manner where we wanted a little bit of a process-oriented document, but in that case, it covers everything, you know, from building the conceptual site model and really also including a lot of the fundamental concepts about fractured rock sites, the type of rocks, how you look at those sites on a regional scale, kind of then funneling down to your site. So it has, I guess, from a proportion standpoint, there's a lot more sort of background information and really good kind of basic understanding of the geology of fractured rock sites. And then it moves through some of these same things in terms of how you set objectives and build a conceptual site model and then select and design and implement remedies. So it's not separated, you know, there's not like a characterization document that's going to be followed by a remediation. It's all in one, but it's getting close to being wrapped up. I think it's coming out here in a couple months.
And it also has a tool selection table that kind of builds on the characterization document that was previously done. That's a very informative tool and very practical and helpful. So it's kind of a, as a practitioner, you probably need to have that available as you evaluate technologies and tools to use.
Yeah, that's a good point, Trevor. So that fractured rock document is it started off with the same tools table that is part of the DNAPL characterization document, but it's building on it and adding to it. So it's like a new and enhanced tools table. So it's a really great resource.
Yeah. The other point you could elaborate on, because I know you work in this section, Ryan, is the 14 compartment is no longer 14. New in the industry.
Right, yeah. So the 14 compartment, there was another set of compartments added that we'll come out with in the Fractured Rock document that is the 21 compartment model. And basically what we're adding is, you know, the rock matrix itself and then the transmissive fracture parts of the rock. So that's all explained in that upcoming document.
Was there any consideration given to long-term stewardship when talking about objectives? I know 20 years is a long time, but what about sites that require 50 years or longer?
Yes. So we recognize that there are many sites that may fall into that category, but what was felt is we need to set interim functional objectives so that, you know, maybe within every, let's say, 5 years or your five-year reviews or some time period, you're kind of checking to see if you're making progress as predicted. And so you're constantly checking your metrics and recalibrating your CSM. If you have an active system, you're looking at the performance of that system, checking it. If it's an M&A program, you're checking to see whether the plume is stable, is shrinking, you're reevaluating risk. So you're always doing something that kind of confirms that you're making progress. And I think it was felt that once you can demonstrate this to, let's say, a regulator, because many of the team members are regulators, then they're more amenable to probably allowing you to go into a long-term monitoring program or whatever the case may be. So there is context with respect, and there's some variability with respect to the time frame if it's greater than 20 years. It doesn't have to be absolute 20 years. But that was a kind of a good number because many of us have been in this field for, 15, 20 plus years and, kind of remain accountable.
Yeah, so one way to look at that is, let's say you do have a site where the current, starting concentration is 10,000 and your goal is to get to 1 in 50 years. I mean, just making this up for to make the math simple. If you've been operating for 5 years and you've gone from 10,000 to 8,000, how do you know if that's enough? Some people might think that you're right on the path to get there because you've gotten that 20% reduction in less than 20% of the time, but others may be expecting more progress. So kind of one analogy that I like to use when thinking about this is, let's say that, someone is setting a goal to lose 75 pounds on a diet, but they want to do it by, next June 1st, to be ready for next summer. And that's the only goal they have. And you're starting to think about how you would behave kind of in the near term. Well, I might, decide that I have the perpetual attitude of, well, I'll just start tomorrow because I still have time to meet my goal. And pretty soon it's February and you haven't gotten anywhere. So that's kind of the idea, is something that is not so far out there that you really can't assess progress toward it.
Is there a quantitative difference, analytical concentration or visual, between free phase and dissolved phase DNAPL, especially with creosote?
I guess not. Quite sure I understand the question. I mean, free phase DNAPL is, by definition, it is the separate phase of contaminant. So if you think of like a clogged sink that you pour Drano in, right, the Drano is the DNAPL. That's the sort of oily blob that sinks to the bottom. And that concentration is, infinite or one or however you want to think about it. It's pure DNAPL. And then the dissolve phase is whatever part of that dissolves into the water. You know, in a simplistic setting like I just described, if that gets to equilibrium, that's going to be the solubility of that constituent. Now, if it's a complex Dean apple with, you know, a mixture, then that changes based on the, you know, the content of the Dean apple. But the dissolve phase concentration is what has, you know, transferred from the Dean apple phase into the water phase.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and wrap up this question and answer break. We're going to have more time for questions at the end of today's training class, we hope. So feel free to send in questions throughout the second half of the training. Also, a reminder, if you do leave before we wrap up, please fill out the feedback form. We really are going to use the information that you provide. We'll continue on with the second half of the training class, and I'm going to turn it over to Dan Bryant at Woodall and Curran.
Thank you, Juliana. So, to this point in the training, Ryan began with an introduction to conceptual site models. Gives us a very good idea of what's there, where it's at, how much is there, where's it going, you know, what's the fate and transport. And then that was followed by Trevor King introducing remedial objectives. So what do we need to do? Or what treatment objective do we need to achieve? So at this point with Chapter 4, we'll talk about what are the technologies we can apply to achieve those remedial objectives. And typically those are based very much on the conceptual site model. So these are all very closely related. So some of the key themes in Chapter 4, how do you avoid the trap of relying on a single remedial technology? Back in the day when I first started in this business, it was quite normal for you to expect one technology to get you from cradle to grave, basically, from a Dean apple type condition to a drinking water standard. And that's just simply no longer accepted. That paradigm has shifted, I think, to recognize that more than one technology is typically going to be required. So how do you consider site characteristics and site goals to decide on technologies? So that's also an important thing that we'll discuss a bit. And then how can you apply multiple technologies and integrate them to help reach your functional objectives? So moving on to slide 38, there are four general parts to Section 4. Section 4.1 is remediation technologies and assessing their performance. Section 4.2 addresses coupling technologies. Section 4.3 is transitioning between technologies. And then I'll finish up with an example, a simple example in Section 4.4. Moving to slide 39, treatment technologies. What we've tried to do in Section 4.1 is provide a good summary of key technologies and what you can reasonably expect with their performance. You'll note as you read this section that we don't give a much discussion about what the ranges of applicability of these technologies are, sort of what their technology niches or sweet spots are, for a couple reasons. First off, there's a lot of other much more detailed technology guides that are available that provide that information for many of these technologies. But also another key thing that came through, and we had this type of discussion on the team, is that there was very little consensus about what type of technology is best for a certain condition, or better yet, which range of conditions are best for a specific type of technology. It all came down to variations in the design, site-specific information, the level of experience of the practitioner. All of this seemed to play a big role in evaluating whether or not a technology was applicable. So that's a very important thing that will come up again in a couple times in this section today. And then also, I'll spend a few moments talking about how to fit technologies and remedy evaluation into the 14-compartment model. So moving to the next slide, this is table 4.1, which summarizes the technologies that we discussed. So basically, in this middle column of this table, what we did, we identified a number of widely applied technologies. We divided them in the left column into three very general technologies for their discussion. Many of these technologies would fall under more than one of these three very general categories. We recognize that. We just sort of divided them based on what we think is their most commonly or predominant category that they would fall under. And then we also provide some references that would provide more detailed information about these individual technologies. So you can find that to augment the information that we provide in the document. So moving to slide 41, let's start by how we can add technologies to the 14-compartment model. Now, we touched on the bedrock and expand this to the 21-compartment model, but if you want to apply technologies to the 14-compartment model, basically what we can do is we can turn into the 42-compartment model if you want. So basically we take each box, and I know that sounds complicated, but it's really, really simple. Basically we take each box, and so in this case, and I'll use the arrow, so in this case, this first column here would be the before case for each individual box, and we assign a number, 0, 1, or 2, which is a very general evaluation, sort of an order of magnitude level evaluation of the concentration that exists before we begin the remediation. In the middle column here, where it shows the red question marks, this is where we apply the technology performance. This is what our technology is going to achieve, also a 0, 1, 2 type number. And then by simple subtraction, we can get to the right-hand column, the after column, which is basically where we need to be or where we will be after application of the technology. All of this is done really at an order of magnitude level of consideration. We're not trying to drill down to 51 parts per billion, but instead think in broader terms, orders of magnitude, or OOMs. So we'll just use that acronym, OOMs. And why do we want to apply these? Well, orders of magnitude play a big role, I think, in a lot of what we do. For example, hydraulic conductivity is typically based on orders of magnitude. We typically talk about 10 minus 3 centimeters per second or 10 minus 5 centimeters per second, each of those being different orders of magnitude. We also often talk about VOC concentrations in terms of OOMs. Are we concerned about parts per billion concentrations or part per milligram per liter concentrations, or now for some even part per trillion type concentrations for certain types of compounds? So again, orders of magnitude keeps coming through. Remediation performance can also be evaluated in the same way by orders of magnitude. For example, a 90% reduction is one order of magnitude. 99.9% reduction is three orders of magnitude. So as additional examples of how OOMs come through. So as an example, in the context of remediation, if our before concentration is 50,000 micrograms per liter, and our after concentration or after remediation concentration is 5 micrograms per liter of whatever our contaminant concern is, then we need four orders of magnitude or 99.99% reduction to go from that before condition to that after condition. So moving now to slide 43, where do we get the OOMs? How do we know if we want to apply technology, what level of performance can we achieve? Well, option number one is your experience and your knowledge. You know your site. You know it better perhaps than anyone else. And based on your experience at those types of sites, what level of performance do you think you can reasonably expect? Option number two, and we'll talk more about this in some upcoming slides, data from the scientific literature. Specifically, I'm talking about multiple site studies or plumathon type studies that combine data from multiple sites. Another resource, we provide a link here, is on the ESTCP website for a DNAPL test system, which provides a lot of case studies in terms of and quantifies their performance in terms of orders of magnitude. And option number three, another very good option, is to consult technology specialists or technology vendors. If you're interested, for example, in thermal remediation at your site and you want to know what is a reasonably achievable objective, consult a thermal remediation vendor who has a lot of experience with that type of technology and that type of site, and they should be able to give you some good advice about what level of performance to expect. Moving to slide 44, let's talk about those multiple site performance studies or plumathon studies. A couple strong points to make about these studies. First off, they're typically performed by independent researchers with careful before and after evaluations of the data rather than, for example, by vendors of the technologies in question. So you would expect them to be more independent in terms of their evaluation of the data. They're designed or intended to be repeatable with a consistent comparison methodology. They're intended to describe the spectrum of sites from high conductivity to low conductivity, DNAPL to dissolve phase, etc. They're based on real data and evaluations of quantitative real data, not anecdotal evidence. And here at the bottom, we just provide the title block from several example studies that are from the peer-reviewed literature. And I'll talk a little bit more about this one here in particular, just on the next slide as an example. So this is a picture, a figure from the McGuire et al. Reference that I showed in the previous slide. They compared technology applications at 59 sites, 59 DNAPL sites, and compared their the performance of different types of technologies. And so this table compares, or this figure compares three. So on the across the x-axis at the bottom are the three technologies, and the y-axis is the percent reduction in source zone concentration for each of these technologies. So the and if you look at each of the three blue boxes, that little red box inside the blue box is the median performance in terms of percent reduction. The width or the length of the blue box is the 25th and 75th percentile, and the total length of the line is the total range that they observe. That red line going horizontal across the figure is 90% reduction, or one ohm, if you will. And if you look, you know, one way of looking at this is you could look at that comparison and say, you know, in terms of the median percent reductions, the three technologies are fairly similar. They all seem to cluster somewhere around that 90% line. But another aspect to look at is the total range of variability, particularly that total range. And if you look, for example, if you compare chemical oxidation or bioremediation on one hand with thermal treatment on the other, you notice that there's a very large difference in the range of performance. And I think a lot of this touches in part on the level of experience that is applied with these technologies. For thermal, most of the applications out there are conducted by a few vendors who are very experienced in their technologies. In contrast to bioremediation or chemical oxidation, which is commonly applied by people that don't have a lot of experience in those technologies, but buy, for example, a drum of a carbon substrate or a drum of a chemical oxidant and can apply those technologies. Now, others would often look at these types of plumethon technologies and say to use some caution. They're not site-specific, so they haven't considered whether or not the technology is applicable to the site. Some lump pilot scale and full scales, and obviously their treatment objectives are going to be different. They don't account for intentional shutdowns. Perhaps, you know, essentially 100% reduction wasn't the objective of treatment. Treatment was stopped after achieving some other goal. They don't account for different levels of experience of the practitioners. And they also cover technology or case studies in some cases that reflect the whole history of the technology. And we our knowledge, our ability to apply technologies typically gets better over time. So we've gotten a lot better. So let's talk now, moving to slide 47, we'll talk about some of the technologies. I'll go through these kind of quickly. So technology category one, removal, physical removal type technologies such as excavation, which can be essentially 100% effective if you've defined your site, if your conceptual site model is accurate. Thermal remediation, for example, one of the plumethon studies discussed results from 14 sites, and they found greater than two orders of magnitude reductions at four sites, less than one order of magnitude at nine sites. One of the sites didn't have sufficient data to draw a conclusion. Category two, slide 48, these are reactive type technologies, chemical and biological, for example. In situ chemical oxidation has a median of about 0.3 ohms in some of the plumethon type studies. One sort of take-home message from these studies is that chemical oxidation applications tend to have a greater prevalence of rebound than other types of technologies. And I think a lot of times this is because there's a lot of unknowns about sites, and chemical oxidation can be a very powerful tool, but it also requires an awful lot of skill and experience to apply it effectively. In situ chemical reduction, another example is the deep soil mixing or ZVI clay process, showed a median reduction of about 1.7 ohms. Moving to slide 49, continuing with chemical and biological technologies, bioremediation. The performance depends somewhat on whether you're considering just the parent compound, the original, for example, the PCE or the TCE, or if you consider all the breakdown products as well. So a median performance of about 1.3 ohms for the parent alone. But if you expand that to consider the breakdown products, about a 0.4 ohm reduction is the median for total CVOCs, for example. And monitored natural attenuation, consider that a technology, and you can typically observe about 0.6 ohms as well. And we should also point out that modern natural attenuation is the sole remedy at about 30% of 45 chlorinated sites that were considered in one of the projects or one of the plumathon studies. Moving to slide 50, containment technologies, pump and treat, for example, can be 100% effective if designed properly and optimized and monitored properly. Permeable reactive walls, about 0.8 orders of magnitude reductions in TCE from one case study or one plumathon with six sites. Low permeability barriers, about 83% of sites met their design objectives. And then, of course, there's solidification stabilization, which we couldn't find a plumathon-type study that summarized results for a lot of sites, but we have seen some very good results for several examples with this type of technology. Now let's move on to section 4.2 and coupling of technologies. And there are three types of coupling that you could think about. Think about temporal coupling, so technology A followed by technology B in the same area. Spatial coupling, which is the technology A, for example, in area A, and technology B in area B. And it can be simultaneous, which sort of combines them. So we might apply technology A in the source area, for example, and technology B in the plume area at the same time. Now, as we were discussing these types of coupling of technologies, a couple of approaches became very clear to us that were widely used. One was to begin with an intensive technology and follow that with a passive technology. For example, thermal remediation as an initial intensive technology followed by monitored natural attenuation for whatever was left after the thermal. It's also common to apply one type of technology in the source area and a different type of technology in a plume area. So that could be spatial or simultaneous coupling. And then finally, something that seems to be very very common in our industry is any technology followed by modern natural attenuation, because rare is it that one technology is going to take you all the way from beginning to end at your site. An important concept is that in the past, what we consider sort of quote-unquote opposing technologies or opposing combinations, such as ISCO followed by bioremediation, were thought to be permanent. You couldn't really couple them, and that really has been proven not to be the case. There's very little that we can do that's going to permanently affect your site and prevent you from applying technologies. It comes down to how you design and accommodate those different technologies with each other. So the rationale for coupling technologies needs to consider contaminant masses, contaminant fluxes, concentrations, and other factors, and how they change over time. Different technologies will be more applicable in different ranges of conditions. Second factor to consider is that remediation objectives may change or understanding of risk may change. So we may have applied technology A to achieve one level. The regulation has changed. We need to achieve a lower level, so we need to apply another technology which may be more applicable under these lower types of conditions. And then also multiple contaminants or classes of contaminants may be present, such as a complex bean apple that has compounds that some have to be chemically oxidized or aerobically biodegraded, whereas others have to be chemically reduced or anaerobically biodegraded. So that can be a rationale for coupling technologies. So in table 4-2, that's here on the right-hand side. You're not intended in any way to be able to read this, so consult the document. That's table 4-2 in the document. We developed a matrix for 9 example technologies, and we ranked them. For example, as generally compatible, these are technologies that are widely or commonly applied together, potentially synergistic. For example, thermal followed by in situ bioremediation. Likely incompatible are combinations that may not work very well. For example, in situ reduction followed by in situ chemical oxidation, which, depending upon how it's designed, could result in sort of ineffective or unproductive destruction of both reagents. And then a third option is potentially compatible but not really anticipated. These are examples of combinations that we as a team weren't aware of, but they would probably work. We're just not aware of them being coupled in this way and not unlikely to be coupled this way. For example, bioremediation followed by surfactant flushing, because surfactant flushing is most commonly applied as a DNAPL remediation technology, and you would expect bio to address the perhaps residual after any mobile recoverable DNAPL has been recovered. Moving to the next slide, slide 54, transitioning between technologies. Potential transition triggers would include, for example, changes in contaminant concentrations. We might think about contaminant phases. For example, applying technology A until the free phase of the DNAP was gone, and then transition to technology B to address the residual. Think about the contaminant lineage. For example, parents versus daughters. Some types of technologies are more applicable for, say, PCE or TC, whereas other technologies may be more applicable for their daughter products, such as cis-1,2-dichloroethene or vinyl chloride. We also think about site conditions that are affected by the execution of technologies. You know, you might be able to address a technology until you've, you know, with a solidification or stabilization to block up the permeability of a site, and then apply a second technology in the areas around it. And then we also should think about the cost effectiveness of technologies. So chemical oxidation, for example, might be very applicable to a site, but it can be done at a much higher cost, or it carries a much higher cost than, say, bioremediation. So you might apply chemical oxidation under a DNAP condition and then follow that with a bioremediation because it's more cost effective to achieve those lower concentrations than chemical oxidation. Moving to slide 55, this is remedy transition. And we have to start thinking about how we are, or what are the factors to consider when you're going to transition from remedy 1 to remedy 2. And we developed a flow chart, and this also ties into the discussions that will follow my presentation in this point of the training. So I've discussed primarily remedy implementation. So follow on sections by Aaron and Tamsin, for example, will talk about the monitoring and the evaluation of that data to assess whether or not we're making progress. Should we continue the remedy? Should we optimize the remedy? And then after we conduct that optimization, repeat the data evaluation step, or do we transition to the next remedy? Now, let's try to pull it all together with a quick example, and this is the focus of section 4.4. What we want to do is we want to couple the 14-compartment model with our OOMs, our orders of magnitude, and remedy performance, and we want to answer the question, will my remedy application achieve my objectives? So in this case, in slide 57, we're going to, again, just in the interest of time, use a relatively simple case study, and it'll be source area excavation. So in this case, you know, again, we've expanded our 14-compartment model, and so we have our before case, which is based on our assessment of the concentrations down here in the key. So in each of the phases for the low permeability series of boxes, we've applied a value, an order of magnitude value. Removal is just that. We're going to dig up the soil and take all the contaminant mass away. So our remedial performance, our technology performance, is essentially going to be 3. It's going to be complete. So what's our condition afterwards? Again, simple subtraction. Now, in this case, we'll stop at 0. But for the low permeability zone, our removal performance is going to leave us with 0 contaminant mass. Our performance will be 100% mass reduction. Similarly, in the transmissive zone, for example, down gradient, our condition, you know, if we excavate our source, our condition before might have these ranges. We're not going to have DNAPL in our plume area sort of by definition, but our before case in the vapor, aqueous, and sword phase could be some fairly significant concentrations. And then our technology performance, if we were to dig those zones up again, would be essentially the same level, 100% removal, leaving us with 0 afterwards. So again, a relatively simple case study, but is intended to illustrate how you could apply these orders of magnitude considerations to your technology performances. So a quick summary to wrap up the Section 4 discussion. 3 important concepts were outlined for Section 4.1. First is that remediation is an order of magnitude affair. So we're concerned about changing from 100 to 1,000 to 10,000 and so on. We can utilize these in the 14-compartment model to get an assessment of how you can, or how your technologies or technology will apply to your site and what level of performance can you expect. And you can derive those levels of performance based on your own experience, multiple site studies, or plumathons, I call them, or by consulting technology experts. In section 4.2, we focused on coupling technologies and a couple of examples. For example, an active followed by a passive remedy, or source remedy versus a plume remedy. And we provided a compatibility matrix, figure 4.2, that we think will be helpful for you in your evaluation of how technologies can be coupled. And then a flow chart in section 4.3, and specifically figure 4.1, can also help, and that also relates to the next two presentations as well. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Aaron Cohen from the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, who will talk about monitoring of technology performances.
Thanks, Dan. So as Dan mentioned, we should all be on slide 59, chapter 5, which is monitoring. This chapter is here to assist the user to determine what data are needed to monitor the site and assess whether or not the selected remedy or remedies are performing as anticipated and or expected. Specifically, we're going to address the two questions shown on the slide. How do you design a monitoring program that assesses your progress towards reaching your functional objectives, and what data should you collect to evaluate remedy performance? Our hope is that you just simply don't collect a whole bunch of data and then place it in a file with sort of an out-of-sight, out-of-mind mentality. This slide, slide 60, illustrates the three types of monitoring that can be performed at a site. Each type is shown on the slide with visual representation, along with one or two typical questions each type of monitoring should answer. We begin at the top of the slide with performance monitoring. This assesses the effectiveness of the SMART functional objectives previously established for the site. The figure shows monitoring wells along a transect across a contaminant plume. Questions you could be asking yourself are, is this remedy reducing contaminant concentrations as expected, or is the remedy working as planned? The goal of performance monitoring is to compare actual data to your SMART functional objectives and provide a yardstick against which you can measure whether or not your remedy is successful. As a regulator, I frequently see sites where a remedy has been implemented, but the performance monitoring is inadequate to demonstrate whether or not the remedy is performing as expected. As a practitioner, the last thing you want to do is to implement a remedy and then be unable to show that it's achieving your objectives. The second type of monitoring shown is process monitoring on the lower left of the slide. Process monitoring is performed to collect data after a treatment system has been turned on or a remedy has been implemented to show whether or not it is working properly and if you're meeting your remedy-specific SMART functional objectives. It's used to answer questions such as, is your system meeting a SMART functional objective of an 80% or greater runtime, or perhaps is the radius of influence of a vapor extraction well more or less than your expected design? Or for an ISCO remedy, maybe something along the lines of, are you injecting at the design pressure and achieving the design flow rate? All this information can be used to optimize the operation of your remedial system in the field and to improve its overall performance. The third type of monitoring shown is compliance monitoring. This is the most common form of monitoring conducted at a site, and it assesses the relationship of contaminant concentrations to regulatory limits. It answers the question whether or not we are meeting regulatory limits. It also serves to document the aerial extent of contamination and the status of exposure. Compliance monitoring locations are often specified by federal, state, or local regulations, and or through a dialogue with stakeholders. So now that we've covered the different types of monitoring, we're going to cover what media to be monitor on the next slide, which should be 61. The type of media you're monitoring should be specified in your functional objectives. If not, then you need to ask yourself, why are we collecting this data, and refer back to your functional objectives to ensure that they meet the specific portion of the SMART criteria. Media types that are usually monitored are DNAPL, aquifer matrix solids, or if you prefer, aquifer sediment or soil, soil gas, groundwater, and surface water. DNAPL is probably the most difficult to measure. Oftentimes, it's not seen at a site. Very high groundwater concentrations may be indicative of its presence, but actually getting in there and measuring it can be quite difficult. So something to keep in mind is, has actual free-phase DNAPL been found at a site, or is the stakeholder team relying on a different type of media to indicate the presence of DNAPL? Next are aquifer matrix solids. These can help establish baseline contaminant concentration levels and can be used during and after a remedial action is completed to evaluate progress, especially if you're addressing a contaminated zone that may be creating back diffusion. If you have subsurface zones of more and less transmissivity, analyzing aquifer matrix solids may provide information as to whether or not the less transmissive zones were successfully treated and the remedy is functioning as expected. Soil gas can be collected to establish if vapor intrusion pathways exist and are of concern. It can also be used as a qualitative screening tool to identify DNAPL sources or highly contaminated areas within the unsaturated zone. Groundwater is the ubiquitous media that's monitored. Most regulations are based upon this media. Mass flux, mass discharges are measured in this media. And ultimately, we are all probably most comfortable in discussing how contaminated a site is when we're talking about groundwater concentrations. Surface water is also listed here because depending on your site conditions, groundwater may be discharging into surface water or into a surface water body, and we didn't want to leave this off the list as a possible media to monitor. So let's move on to slide 62 and discuss metrics. The metrics for monitoring media are listed here. Once the media is selected, it's important for the whole team to understand what metrics are going to be reported. They go along with the concentrations that are being measured. Concentration data is dependent upon the media being measured and is typically reported in micrograms or milligrams per liter, milligrams per kilogram, and PPMV, which is parts per million by volume, for groundwater, soil, aquifer matrix solids, and soil gas, respectively. Contaminant mass is usually measured in kilograms. Mass flux is typically measured in grams per meter squared per day. If you integrate this across the perpendicular area the material is flowing through, then this measurement becomes mass discharge, and it's measured in grams per day. For more information on mass flux and mass discharge, I would certainly encourage you to attend the September 28th ITRC mass flux guidance class, or at least look at the document. So after discussing the media to monitor, what we're going to talk about is how can we evaluate the data. What you wanted to do is determine how your remedy is functioning and whether or not your remedy is achieving your objectives. And to do this, you need to evaluate your data. As mentioned previously, the CSM is a living document, and as such, it needs to be maintained and improved. A great way to do this is to incorporate all the data that you collect while implementing your remedy back into the CSM. You can use your data to improve your understanding of the site as well as to evaluate remedy performance. Data can also be put to good use when you incorporate it into a visualization tool, as shown on this slide, to communicate site conditions. You can illustrate changes over time, and you can improve site understanding for both the project team and stakeholders. You know, let's face it, it's generally easier for most people to get an understanding of site conditions if you illustrate them in a picture rather than presenting them with a stack of data tables or an incredibly thick report. The big thing data is used for is evaluation. This is where statistics can be helpful. Statistics can be useful to identify and understand trends. The point here is to use your data to determine whether or not you are achieving your functional objectives. Questions to consider might be, is your remedy performing as expected? Does it need to be optimized? Should your remedy be reevaluated? The last thing you want to do is to continue to operate a remedy that's not achieving objectives. You know, simply put, you're just wasting your time, your resources, and your money. So moving on to slide 64, we're going to talk about trends. Trending is the most common statistical methods, and it's a way to quantify and or quantitatively rather describe the rate at which change is occurring. It can take you it can allow you to, you know, look at your progress towards achieving functional objectives. It can help you to determine a predictive rate at which your objectives will be achieved. Trending can also be used to determine if stakeholders are comfortable with the rate of progress and time required to achieve your objectives, or do more aggressive actions need to be taken to decrease the time frame to reach those objectives. The figure at the right on the slide is from Chapter 5 in the document, and it illustrates a decision framework from which to begin the data trend interpretation process. You start at the text box, circle in red, and the text asks you whether or not the groundwater source or plume is being actively treated. Depending upon your answer, yes or no, you move either into the blue pathway indicating remediation is occurring or the orange pathway indicating remediation is not occurring. You then look at your data and determine if your trend is increasing, stable, or decreasing, or if there's no trend at all, depending upon whether or not you are performing active treatment. If you have active treatment, you can refer then to Table 5.2, or if you have no active treatment, you refer to Table 5.3 within the document that offer possible interpretations and the types of decisions that are needed based upon the trends you're assessing. Moving on to slide 65, you can also use your data to help model the performance you see at your site. Modeling can be helpful and informative, as well as a great visual tool to show what's taking place at your site. It can help answer questions such as what's going on, you know, is the CSM accurately reflecting what the data is telling you, and does your CSM accurately communicate what you expect it to communicate? There are different types of models out there. The two most common are source zone models, which simulate the impact of remediation or monitored natural attenuation on your source zone, and robust fate and transport models that can be used to evaluate plume stability and attempt to simulate 2 and 3D plume movement. A couple of examples of the models out there are REMCLOR and the natural attenuation software, both of which are mentioned here. One thing to remember, though, is that most current models are based on the advection dispersion model, and new information that Ryan mentioned in his earlier discussion on geology indicates that perhaps the advection diffusion model may be a little more accurate when dealing with DNAPL sites. Moving on to slide 66. So here's an example that brings together modeling data with actual monitoring results. It's a great way to look at a site and see if your actual on-site data correlates with your modeled or predictive data. Do the two correlate, or is there a wide gulf between them? The figure on the right shows contaminant concentrations versus time on a log scale. If we start at the lower right-hand corner of the slide with MW59, we see the well is located in the source zone and that the figure shows that the monitoring data matches relatively well with what the model predicted based upon what would happen if we performed aggressive source zone treatment and what type of concentration decrease we might expect to see. Next, we move down gradient of the treatment zone to well MW29, where there's a permeable reactive barrier wall had been installed. The figure shows the impact of the remedy, and again, the monitoring data matches up pretty well with the modeling data. Finally, we move completely down gradient of the PRB to well MW37. The model and the monitoring data, again, both show the delayed impact that the treatment had at the site. Moving on to slide 67. So now let's take a step back and realize that a lot can happen over the time frame in which your remedy is implemented and operated. As your site transitions from remedy implementation to operation to long-term monitoring, your data needs change. It's important to realize that as your site conditions change, so will your monitoring requirements. Your monitoring program should be periodically evaluated and optimized. Some questions you might ask yourself are, you know, is my current program still relevant and applicable? Should it remain static, or does it need to change? Am I collecting redundant data, or do I actually have data gaps at my site? Should I change the frequency of my monitoring events? Perhaps currently you're monitoring monthly. Maybe you're better served by collecting data quarterly or annually or semi-annually or biennially or every 5 years. Once you address the question of monitoring frequency, you should consider the question of what data are being collected. This should be spelled out in your functional objectives, but you also need to ask yourself, do I need to collect and analyze for the entire suite of contaminants and parameters, or can the sampling analysis of just one or two key compounds explain the big picture at my site? As a regulator, one of the things I hate to see is a non-optimized monitoring program. I frequently see sites with lots of data, and one of the first things I notice is that the same wells have been sampled quarterly for the last few years or longer, and a large portion of them are below detection limits and have been below detection limits for some time. You aren't doing yourself or your clients any favors by expending time, effort, and money on the collection of data that doesn't improve or update your CSM. The caveat to all of this is that sometimes you may be required to perform long-term monitoring of a well that is below detection limits to satisfy a regulatory requirement. As with modeling, there are several free tools available to help you evaluate and optimize a monitoring well network. The two that come to mind are shown here, and they are MAROS and GTS. So moving on to slide 68. This slide illustrates how your monitoring strategy should bring everything together. It's sort of a crazy picture that shows a combination of field data, lab data, screening data, maybe some literature data, and it combines all of that with site-specific knowledge and experience, modeling results, data analysis tool results, and the current CSM to try and understand what the data is telling us and how we can evaluate it. This all feeds together to create a body of knowledge that allows you to make technically based decisions and a well-reasoned evaluation of the remedy with respect to attaining your functional objectives. So that pretty much wraps up the monitoring section. At this time, I'm going to turn the presentation over to Tamsin McBeth from CDM Smith, who's going to talk about Chapter 6.
Thanks, Aaron. So now that Aaron's gone through the discussion on the monitoring strategy and really, you know, discussed the basis of evaluating the data and evaluating the trends, we're really moving into the next segment of the training, which is reevaluating the entire remedy. And so this is included in Chapter 6. And as shown on this figure, this is really where the feedback loop portion of the training comes in, and it kind of just goes through the entire remedial strategy. Just to back up a little bit, as Trevor discussed, this guidance is really focused on this process, and this entire process is reviewed and developed in this chapter 6. The reality is that most sites have already been in the regulatory process, such as CERCLA, for some time and have a long history, in some cases very extensive history, of characterization and remediation. And so most of the time, sites are really starting at this point where they're really evaluating the remedy. And so this chapter is focused on how you implement, optimize, and revise the DNAPL site strategy based on making progress towards achieving your objectives. And if you aren't meeting those objectives, how to really reevaluate the overall strategy and at what point and at what pieces you need to reevaluate. So one thing of note is that often when we're not achieving objectives, the first thing that happens is everyone assumes that the technologies that were applied failed. And so what happens is we get into this feedback loop of applying a technology and it doesn't meet the objective, so we try another technology and it doesn't meet the objective. What this process changes in that feedback loop is not going back to the technologies, but really evaluating whether it was the conceptual site model, perhaps that it was insufficient and is really not informing good decision making, or perhaps whether your absolute and functional objectives really weren't set up very well, they weren't realistic, they aren't really supporting good decision making for the remedy, there aren't good interim remedial objectives. And so really starting there before you go back and look at technologies. So those are the steps we're going to go through in this particular chapter. So first key questions to consider when we're looking at reevaluating the sites, it's all about objectives. And are we meeting those objectives? Are we meeting all those functional specific objectives? Is that progress acceptable? Are there areas that we can be more efficient or effective? And what do we do if we're not? So first of all, the first question really is, are objectives being met? And determining if objectives are being met is generally addressed under a scheduled, like, five-year review under CERCLA, and, you know, often under these comprehensive site reviews. And this is where I've come into the process in really reevaluating these remedies, is during these kind of long-term reviews, it's recognized that objectives really aren't being met. These reviews should really identify any changes that have occurred, the rate of progress, identify new potential risks, as well as opportunities for improvement, such as optimizing the remedy. Periodic reviews of the data are generally required. One thing of note is that you need to ensure that the timing of the data evaluation is sufficient to support the decisions that you're trying to make in terms of whether those objectives are being met, and the timing of the remedy reviews also can vary. So timing can be really important. You have to look at it from both a technology perspective. If you have interim goals with technology process or performance monitoring, and also our kind of long-term monitoring, such as if we're achieving the ultimate remedial action objectives. So the first question, really, if we have answered the question, are functional objectives being met? No. The second question is really, is progress towards those objectives acceptable? The progress can be acceptable, but the question still needs to be asked whether or not optimization really makes sense and whether best practices are being implemented at the site. We're working in an industry that's constantly evolving in terms of technologies, applications, integrating new concepts, things like sustainability, into the decision-making and the remedies and how we're implementing those remedies are all important considerations. And this really is the part of the process where we have the opportunity to really ask whether the remedy can be optimized. So why would you want to optimize? Of course, we want to enhance the efficiencies of the system. We want to reduce costs, but we also want to ensure that we're using or maximizing our resource use by incorporating things like sustainability. And again, also making sure that our technologies are optimized. And there are really a whole slew of guidance documents out there on technology optimization for specific technologies like pump and treat systems or groundwater remedy review. EPA just recently released a guidance document on optimizing groundwater remedies. Table 6.2 of the document kind of goes through a process for evaluating optimization, and we do provide five brief alternative ITRC-specific guidance documents and kind of detail key aspects of process optimization. So once we've gone through the optimization component, and we have determined in this case that we're really not making sufficient progress towards meeting our objectives. So in this case, this is the third question for this chapter, how do I really troubleshoot the remedy if we're really not meeting the functional objectives or they're not being met at an acceptable rate? So again, this feedback loop really starts with, let's revisit the purpose of a conceptual site model and ensure that the conceptual site model that's being used incorporates the latest understanding of the type of site you're working with, and that it's really sufficient to make the decisions that you're trying to make. And one of the things this guidance provides is a couple of checklists so that you can go through and look at what a conceptual site model should include. And Appendix C actually has a checklist of important CSM elements so that you can just, as a screening tool, look at whether you're missing any of those key elements. Design and operation of remedial systems really is based on this original CSM, but again, the CSM is a living document, and it should be continually updated and revised throughout the different stages of the remedy, including design and implementation. Now, we often learn the most about a site during implementation of remedial actions. You know, you're going out there, you're installing injection wells, you're installing extraction wells, you know, all of those activities provide opportunities to learn more about the site. And so really, if things aren't working the way that it was intended, I would say more often than not, the reason is the conceptual site model, and really needing to go back and take a look at that. So the team really conferred a lot about why CSMs fail, and you know, we recognize that chlorinated solvent sites, as Ryan described, you know, can be very complicated. You've got primary sources, you've got secondary sources, you have matrix diffusion elements, you can have complex hydrogeology and heterogeneity, you know, and all of these things, as is shown in this figure, really components to why building a good CSM can sometimes be difficult. So one of the things that we did is rather go through all the potential elements of a CSM is we listed or provided some context about common things that are often inaccurate in CSMs and really lead to sort of poor decision making. Key elements include things like not really delineating the third dimension of your site, you know, only evaluating those 2D plume maps, not really looking at the vertical dimension, evaluating heterogeneity and soil stratigraphic layers, and really understanding how contaminants are distributed within those heterogeneous layers, and how groundwater moves through those heterogeneous layers. Looking at seasonal changes, you know, I can't tell you how many sites I've come to where they developed a potentiometric surface map during the RI, and, you know, 15 years later, they're still describing groundwater flow based on that original potentiometric surface map. And when we go in and we look at this dynamic potentiometric surfaces, we find that very often you can have significant variability in groundwater flow magnitude and direction seasonally. In spring, it might be one direction, and in fall, it might be another. And also looking at kind of this vapor phases and transport, geochemistry. So, you know, all of these things really need to be considered when you're looking at why your site is not making good progress. So the next thing after we've felt confident that our conceptual site model is really sufficient is to really revisit the objectives. And this sometimes takes people back. You know, why would we revisit our remedial objectives? And hopefully, you know, after having gone through the functional and the absolute objectives, as well as this timeline, that, you know, you really want to set interim objectives that are within this sort of 20 years so that you can make, you know, progress towards those objectives in a meaningful way, that progress that Ryan was talking about. You know, you don't want to set these, you know, objectives that are going to be met in 500 years. That doesn't give you a really tangible means of defining what steps you need to take to meet those ultimate objectives. And so again, just to revisit, I think one of the most important elements of this guidance is to develop these interim objectives, make sure that they're SMART, make sure that those metrics are really aligned with the objectives. And, you know, people sort of, you know, look at us, but often what we will do in groundwater remedies is we will set compliance objectives at compliance points that might be really far away from a source zone, for instance. And so if the travel time is 9 years from the source zone to the distal portion of the plume, you know, setting objectives in that distal well for the source treatment is not really constructive. You know, you need to set objectives within the source area for that source treatment. And it seems rational, but, you know, it very often it's not. And so the other thing is that we really need to make sure that we have realistic expectations for technology performance. Very often, you know, rods for remedies for DNAPL sites assumes that one technology would be able to achieve closure. But now, because of our, you know, understanding of the way these DNAPL sites work, it's recognized that you're often going to need multiple technologies. And so defining those interim objectives, you know, what's the first technology going to really buy you? What's the second technology going to really buy you? It's something that needs to be well thought out on the outset so that expectations can be managed. And really, again, interim objectives and defining those. So once we have gone through and we've really looked at the remedy, we've looked at the objectives, we've defined the overall remedial strategy, and we're implementing that remedial strategy, the next element is really now, you know, looking at technologies. Is there something going on with the technology? And that really is the problem with the remedy. So this iterative approach to troubleshooting technology is often required. You know, this, we implement the technology and we're kind of evaluating or we're predicting what the expected performance is, but we need to sort of track the actual performance based on that expected performance. Again, using things like Aaron talked about, data trends, evaluation of whether the remedial action has reached a point of diminishing returns or even really no recognizable benefit. You know, if your pump and treat system is pumping negligible amounts of groundwater or removing negligible amounts of mass at really high cost, you know, that's a good time to really kind of rethink that strategy. And ensuring that best practices are really, in terms of the technology application, are being applied and looking at improvements for either the existing technologies that are being applied and potentially looking at replacing the existing technologies with new technologies. So again, the integrated DNAPL site strategy really includes building a remedy by assigning these technologies to the compartments, as Dan said, and you know, selecting technologies based on estimated performance like reductions in contaminant mass flux or discharge, to kind of build this conceptual understanding of these various compartments, where the technologies fit in, what the technologies are going to buy you in the end, and iteratively evaluating that and through sort of the decision process and the implementation. And this technology mapping, if you will, you know, it can be a very important element in reevaluating the site and looking at performance. So now we're going to go through some technology discussions. The information from the three categories on the previous slide come together to really make decisions about whether you need to continue with the existing technology, whether you need to optimize the existing technology, or whether you just need to cease the operations of that technology and transition to a new technology. And so we're going to go through a case example of that decision process. And in this case, this conceptual example, this is a hypothetical example to illustrate technology implementation decision points for a multi-component strategy. This is figure 6.1 in the guidance document, and this is really a data evaluation for a chlorinated solvent site where the remedy included an aggressive treatment for a source zone followed by monitored natural attenuation. And the overall objective was to reduce the mass discharge from the source zone by 99% within 5 years. And to achieve this objective, it was expected that the aggressive treatment technology would reduce the contaminant discharge by 90% within 5 months, followed by a transition to M&A to reduce mass discharge by the additional 9% over the course of the next 4.5 years. So in this case, this sort of shows we're evaluating the implementing that aggressive treatment technology, and we're evaluating the trends. And in this case, we're really evaluating the performance near the time of expected shutdown of that aggressive treatment. And it's realized, as is shown in this figure, that only a 60% reduction in contaminant mass discharge was achieved within that treatment time period instead of the desired 90%. So in this case, should we continue with this aggressive treatment, which is presumably also expensive, or should we continue operation until we achieve that 90% reduction in discharge? So in this case, this figure compares the two options' impact on the overall objective of a 99% reduction. Without additional treatment, it will take monitored natural attenuation 6.5 years to achieve that functional objective. So it's going to extend the time frame for meeting objectives by 2 years. And if this expanded time frame is acceptable, then you can sort of just revisit or refine those functional objectives in that it's going to take now 7 years to achieve that 99% reduction instead of 5. And if that's acceptable within the time frame of meeting that objective, then go ahead, shut that aggressive treatment down. If it's not okay, then at this point you need to look at either troubleshooting that aggressive treatment option, just continuing to operate it until you meet the goal, or potentially to transition it to another technology, maybe a less aggressive technology, but an enhanced remediation technology relative to what M&A will buy you to achieve the overarching objective within the desired time frame. So that just gives you an idea, you know, about how you can reevaluate these interim decision points, you know, as you're kind of adaptively managing the remedy and adjusting things based on what your primary drivers are for the site and the timeframes for meeting those objectives. So overall, we're going to kind of wrap up here the remedy evaluation summary. Again, the conceptual site model is a living document. We need to make sure that our objectives are smart and that our objectives are really serving as the framework for remediation decision making and that they make sense in the context of the remedy that you're implementing. You need to plan these transitions, really define these interim goals, define when you're applying technologies, when you're transitioning from one technology to another, really evaluate the performance pretty continually, and reevaluate, adjust, and adapt your strategy as necessary based on the response to the remedial actions that you're implementing. And with that, I'm actually going to turn it over to Alex McDonald with the California Water Board.
Thank you. Thank you, Tamsin. Everyone should be here on slide 82. I'll be quick here so we can get to our question and answer period. We're running out of time. As we said in the beginning, our team got together and we were looking at issues with all these sites not meeting remediation goals. We're very unhappy. Clients are very unhappy. Responsible parties. So we came up with, well, what's the problem? And what we saw was there was sites that have DNAPLs. There was really the site's conceptual model was inadequate. It wasn't really didn't understand all the different complexities that you find at a DNAPL site. And those complexities can be man-made and they can be naturally occurring. And you have a contaminant that's in four different phases. So you need to take that all into consideration. And then a lot of the sites had unrealistic remedial objectives. There's, you know, either time frame was too fast since the type conceptual model wasn't adequate, the objective couldn't be met because the understanding of where you placed the remedy and what remedy you used was not sufficient. And so given all that, we came up, okay, what can we do to fix the problem? Or we can make the problem better, give a way for people to actually analyze these sites and make a better remedy decision. So that's how we came up with the integrated DNAPL-SAT strategy that you just went through today. And so if you look at the bottom of the slide, there's basically three documents we think will help you out in this regard. One is the site strategy we discussed today. The second one is the site characterization tool and tool selection document that came out in 2015, and the use of measurement of mass flux and mass discharge. All three of those documents will help you give basically a better site conceptual model, better way to set objectives, and a better way to come up with a remedy for your site. Go to slide 83. As we discussed today, here's what we did, the five different chapters we discussed. You know, Ryan gave a talk on site conceptual model and all the complexities are involved there, especially if you have a DNAPL site. Even if you don't have a DNAPL site, all these processes should be followed if you want to come up with a good site strategy. Trevor gave a talk on setting SMART remedial objectives, and so using that acronym, specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-bound, come up with objectives that actually can be used and come up with a better way to assess your site and the remediation approach. The third thing was Dan talked about how to do remedial approaches using OOMS and a 14 compartment model. So those would give a better way to actually assessing a proper remedy for your project. Then you had Aaron talking about how to monitor your site to see if you are meeting your remedial objectives. And Tamsin wrapped it up with how to evaluate your remedy, how to optimize your remedy, and then potentially having to reassess your conceptual site model, which tends to be the biggest bugaboo, and then potentially even having to reevaluate the remedial objectives that you set. Going to slide 84, a little more discussion on the integrated DNAPL site characterization document coming out It's been out for a couple of years. We're having training on it next week. So make sure you go to the ITRC website and download that document. And if you can, recommend that you attend that training next week. And then the last slide I have is the mass flux and mass discharge document we produced back in 2010. Also next week, there'll be another training on that. So hope to hear you listening in on our talk next week. And with that, we'll turn over to Juliana for our last question and answer period.
Thanks, Alex. We will have time for a few questions, so you're welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. I do have a couple of poll questions for you as we wrap up today. Would you recommend using the integrated Dean Apple site strategy described today? And thinking about projects that you're working on, in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance? So we have both of those poll questions set so that you can see answers from other people as they're coming in on Adobe Connect. We have links to additional resources, and you can follow that link here on the slide. We also have a link to our feedback form, and we do ask that everyone fill out the feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide. It's also your opportunity to create a certificate, so be sure to check the box at the bottom that confirms that you attended today. Once you submit, the system's then going to generate that certificate. And right now, the only way to get the certificate is by filling out the feedback form. So if you forget to check that box, just go back, check the box, submit again, and the system will then generate that certificate for you. Also, we've mentioned those upcoming classes. So next week, September 26, the Integrated Dean Apple Site Characterization, and September 28, Use and Measurement of Mass Flux and Mass Discharge. So itrcweb.org to register for those classes. We're watching for questions to come in through the Q&A, so that's in the lower right where we have those questions that are coming in. We're also seeing our results of our poll questions come through, so we have most people on the call today that would recommend using this strategy described today. Also, thinking about projects that you're working on, we have some people that are thinking about refreshing their conceptual site model. Another person has a less site that they'll be able to incorporate these same components, and as Alex just mentioned, the same process does work on more than just Dean Apple sites. We have additional people, Ben, who are also looking at their CSM as they consider their technologies, and I certainly think that's a message that we've given during today's class. We do have a couple more minutes, so I want to go ahead and wait to see if we do have questions from our audience that come in. Again, more information about upcoming classes. We have several classes coming in October. October 3, Geophysical Classification for a Munitions Response. October 5, Issues and Options in Human Health Risk Assessment, a resource when alternatives to default parameters and scenarios are proposed. October 12, Groundwater Statistics for Environmental Project Managers. October 26, Geospatial Analysis for Optimization at Environmental Sites. And both of these later October classes are great classes if you have groundwater data and you're trying to figure out what to do with it. So October 12, Groundwater Statistics for Environmental Project Managers, and October 26, Geospatial Analysis for Optimization at Environmental Sites. We also have a two-day classroom training on petroleum vapor intrusion coming up April 10 through 12 in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and it does include a bonus day three from the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. So if you are interested in that petroleum vapor intrusion classroom training, email us at training@itrcweb.org. A question has come in. How much of the total effort should be dedicated to site characterization and assessment?
Sorry, Juliana, could you repeat that?
How much of the total effort should be dedicated to site characterization and assessment?
Yeah, so this, we get this question a lot. A general rule of thumb, at least initially, is that you likely want to be spending about 10%, you know, of the remedy cost in characterization, with more the more complex your site is. So if you're thinking your remedy is going to be, say, a $5 million, you know, source remedy, you want to be spending about $500,000 at least in characterization to, you know, start your conceptual site model. Now, that obviously is a number that's not rooted in a lot of data at this point, but just the kind of collective survey of our practitioners on the board, that was kind of the rough rule of thumb that we all thought, yeah, that's probably about right.
Thank you. A couple other questions have come in. One about getting to the feedback form. So if you have trouble getting to the feedback form for the links we have here on the slide, you can go to the related links, and it's the fourth item down. They'll take you to the feedback. Also, from that registration confirmation, if you go back to the Clue-In training page where you started today, along the left, there's a link to that feedback form. So let us know if you have trouble getting to the feedback, and we can send you that direct link as well. Also, from that main Clue-In training page, you can read more about our trainers. A question came in that someone wants to see more about the trainers today. And so we have bios available for the trainers. So I read just a little bit of their bios at the beginning of the class, but if you'd like to read more about our trainers, that information is available, and that's back on that Clue-In training page where you started today. We are out of time for today's class.